Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I am Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky, your standard discussing.
We're the group, regular wrecking crew.
Yeah, we're something.
We're just the average something. Joes.
Yeah, the average Joes. We could rename the podcast, you know, the average Joes, or the average Joes talk nuclear, something to that effect. So today, you know, we were thinking about a handful of topics, but there was a great, it was an article that was on the website, the Foreign Affairs website, and I read it and thought, you know, this sort of opens us up to a broader discussion on an important topic that we've never talked about. And of course, I'm talking about, when do nuclear weapons, you know, what is their purpose and when do they work? And when does deterrence work? And when is it supposed to work? And so there was an article, When Nuclear Weapons Fail to Deter, by Paul Avey. And I don't know if it's in the latest issue of Foreign Affairs. I think this is a web-only article. But it was an interesting piece that talked about some current cases in which non-nuclear states are, you know, engaging in wars and acting aggressively against nuclear states. And, of course, they're talking about Iran's attacks on Israel. You know, you can talk about, Ukraine's movement of its forces into Russia and some of the attacks. And, of course, Russia attacked Ukraine first. But Ukraine has been, aggressive in their effort to try to, you know, persecute this war and win and deter and push the Russians out. And so there's a number of cases in which, you know, non-nuclear states have not really been fearful that they would be attacked with nuclear weapons by the superior power. And so I thought that would be a great discussion for us to have. And you know, if you go back to the New Look policy and, you know, criticism today amongst, you know, scholars and analysts of Dwight Eisenhower's New Look policy, they say, well, you know, nuclear weapons, you know, they can't deter everything. And so I thought we would just have a nice discussion about the idea of, when are nuclear weapons, what are they designed to do? And why is that important? And have that broader discussion. So with that, Curtis, you read it, Jim read it. What were some of the sort of the main ideas that this spurred you towards? You know, it was just sort of a fundamental article. And as you read it, Curtis, what did you think in terms of, you know, just this broader discussion?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. It's good to see you and good to be here. I just want to point out the article's title is When Foreign Weapons Fail to Deter, The Ultimate Weapon Is Not Always the Best Defense, by Paul Avey, who is an associate professor of political science at Virginia Tech University. I don't know this individual. Virginia Tech's a good school. I'm sure it's, he's thinking about this issue. I really found this article to be, interesting in the sense that it does sort of foster this idea that nuclear deterrence is an all or nothing sort of thing, that it always works all the time. And we know that's not the case. And nuclear deterrence was never meant to work all the time for all cases. It wasn't ever meant to deter all war. It was meant to avert large-scale war, like a world war, in the traditional sense that we might understand it, or perhaps, you know, a nuclear attack, right? Specifically for nuclear weapons. And so I think the article sort of acts like it's surprised by this idea that, well, there's still all this strife in the world. And he goes all the way back to Vietnam and other issues. Doesn't doesn't bring up the Falklands in 1982, but that's another example of a non-nuclear state sort of going to war with a nuclear state. I don't know. There's just a sort of idea that, they still went to war, so therefore these nukes are really worthless. Really, there's no appreciation for the value of escalation control that nukes brought to any of these issues, and I hope we'll explore some of these one-on-one. But I want to just bring up real quick for our audience this idea. The author sort of teases that, you know, the ultimate deterrent appeared to carry a little threat in some of these conflicts that he discusses. And I want to remind everybody that it is America's official policy that the United States will not use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states that are a party to the nuclear the NPT. I'm sorry, I'm having a brain fart here. The NPT, and who are in compliance with their nuclear non-proliferation obligations. This was clearly stated in a 2018 NPR under President Trump, and restated the same thing that I just read in the Biden 2022 NPR. This also is a public policy statement of the People's Republic of China. Take that for what it's worth. So it should not be a surprise that if we are engaged with a non-nuclear state, that we wouldn't go right to the nuclear threat.
Yeah, that's a good point, Jim.
Well, you know, I noticed with my neighbor, he keeps dumping his trash in my yard, and he's seen me building my nuclear weapon in my garage, and it has failed to stop him from throwing trash in my yard. So, you know, I'm trying to figure out how this ultimate weapon doesn't work. Just tongue in cheek, you know, sort of highlighting what Curtis said. But, you know, let me highlight a couple things from it.
It
first
might
of all,
be more credible if you said you were building your C-Wiz mount that was pointing directly at your trash pile. And then if he stepped in that C-Wiz mount's, radar cross section, then he was just a splatter of...
Yeah. Go ahead. Well, that gets us back to our autonomous weapons discussion.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. But, you know, first of all, the concept, you know, when nuclear weapons fail to deter. Well, it's what nuclear weapons fail to deter might be a better article to write. What they fail to deter and what they do deter are two different things. And even the concept, as Curtis mentioned here, that we don't think of a deterrence, is in the non-proliferation side of this, it deters that aggression as well. Because what happens in the secondary act of deciding to not proliferate, you also are saving yourself from being attacked by other nuclear weapon states, provided they follow their rules. And some people follow their rules, or some nations follow the rules, and some, you know, they sort of sign treaties, but they, you know, fail to follow those. But anyway, at least it's some assurance when you are not proliferating that you're not going to be attacked by another nuclear weapon state. Sort of interesting, at least in that concept that, you know, Curtis talked about, that's in the NPTP. The other piece is, I do like, and I don't know Paul Avey at all. I don't know his stance in the world. I agree that the nuclear weapon is the ultimate weapon, but there's no weapon that's always the best defense. And in this podcast, I've learned a lot about various ways in which we have looked at implementing nuclear weapons, ways that we can implement a nuclear weapon in terms of short range, long range, strategic, tactical, underwater, overwater, space-based, whatever you want to talk. You need a variety of weapons, because there is no single weapon that your adversary is simply going to bow down and say, we're done. They are going to find a way. As I've always said, with every key, there's a lock. With every lock, there's a key. Okay? And your adversary is going to find a way to break that lock. You've got to come up with something else. Mean dogs, you know, armed guards, whatever that weapon that Adam talked about. You got to have something ready to take someone out when they break your next lock. So there is no single weapon. That doesn't mean it's not bad. Locks are great, but they don't always work. What you have to do is have a strategy that reinforces it, so you keep anyone from breaking in, or anyone taking over your nation, or anyone attacking your nation and destroying your way of life, which is what the strategic weapons do. they protect, you know, they protect countries against this large scale war, this major takeover. Last, I want to point out the other piece that I don't recall seeing it in here. Maybe it's in here. But just as a reminder to everyone, Russia attacked Ukraine. That was not a nuclear nation attacking another nuclear nation. It's a nuclear nation attacking another prior nuclear nation. That might have something to do with what the actions that occurred. So I pull that one out of the hat, too. So those are the things I got out of this, Adam, that I agree. It's a bread and butter kind of article. But we, you know, we could expand on this a little bit beyond that because of the effects and development of the nuclear weapons in terms of policy and strategy, not effects in terms of blast, you know, overpressure, et cetera. Although they're important, just not for this conversation.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I think we don't talk about enough is, you know, and I would call the article, you know, what nuclear weapons are designed to deter, because they're very clearly not designed to deter everything, right? I mean, they prevent existential war. They prevent, you know, great power war, you know, which, you know, one of the critiques of nuclear weapons is this idea, well, if all nuclear weapons are designed to do is to deter the use of nuclear weapons by another nuclear armed adversary, then just get rid of them all. And well, it's not really the only thing that they do. So that what else do they do? Well, they deter nuclear attack by the Soviets or the Chinese. They deter great power wars because, you know, what do great powers have? Generally, they have allies and friends. And for most states, their number one source of conflict is neighbors. Just like with me, you know, the people I dislike most are my neighbors. And so, you know, where does conflict come from? Those who live next door to you on the right. And, you know, so what do great powers do? Well, they constrain their neighbors, and they constrain their neighbors' desire to fight their neighbors. So you start to go down this pyramid, and it's great powers can not only not fighting other great powers, but they're now constraining their weaker allies who then don't fight, you know, others, because those, you know, traditional adversaries might be the ally of the other great power with nuclear weapons. So you start to see an overall reduction in conflict. And so they get fewer, and then they get smaller. And then as you go down that conflict pyramid, you're left with things like insurgencies and terrorism and things that don't present existential threats to most states. And then, you know, if you read the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review, they have a great chart in it that shows that conflict-related casualties have declined since 1945, right? We averaged about 1% to 2% of the world's population died in conflicts every year, and that's declined by 95%, which that's because of nuclear weapons. And, oh, by the way, what do we spend less on? Well, if as the U.S., you know, when we fight world wars, we spend 40 to 50% of our GDP on war fighting, which is very expensive. And when we don't fight those wars, we don't spend that money. So the overall expenditures on wars have gone down. And our defense budgets, if you look at them, we're at 2.8% right now. We're going to have a hard time keeping up with the Europeans if they spend any more money than they have been, because nuclear weapons allow you to spend less on defense. So there's all these secondary things that nuclear weapons do that we don't ever talk about, but those are really positive things, you know, like when we don't spend on fighting wars and we don't turn our factories from building commercial consumer products into, you know, building war machines, then we as Americans get to live a higher standard of living. And these are all positives that nuclear weapons bring about. And so the idea that they are somehow a failure because they don't deter everything.
Yeah.
That's sort of a misnomer.
Adam, I really like that. And before Curtis jumps in, I know he's ready to. For our listeners, when I was talking, I saw Curtis grimace when I talked about the secondary effects. So I want to add to your list. The other thing that nuclear weapons do is they stop other people from building nuclear weapons because of the threat of building more. We've seen that in the non-proliferation. And that's sort of an interesting aspect I hadn't thought about until I read this article, was thinking about these secondary effects. And so, so Curtis, I know you grimaced because maybe I didn't say it the right way, but that is that secondary effect I like. And by the way, for those that aren't watching and don't see the grimaces, et cetera, if you do go to Rumble or you do go to YouTube, you'll see that I'm in my Ohio 70 degree outfit, because here in Ohio, when it's 70 degrees, it's like being at the beach. And so I'm having a good time. Do you, Curtis?
I have to say, you look great in that Hawaiian shirt and sunglasses. You know, it's an interesting point here that you made earlier, Jim, that you said that maybe the deterrence isn't hampered as much by whether you have them or you don't have them, but whether or not you have the right ones, paraphrasing what I think you said, mm-hmm. and at least that's what I heard. And I think that is interesting. You know, if you only have big, high-yield systems, then you're going to be very uncredible, if there's such a word, to use them in a small conflict. And so this is why they are quite useless. And to be fair, McNamara and Kennedy in 1961 realized that when they took over the government and began switching from the massive retaliation strategy to flexible response and assured destruction. So we can see that philosophy actually has roots in the test of time. But we also don't really appreciate is the value of nuclear weapons in what they have in here. And Professor Avey notes in this piece, when he talks about that nuclear states compete intensely with one another, but this competition almost never escalates to large-scale conflict. That sounds like a good thing to me. His study there. But he notes that Glenn Snyder's speculation back in the 60s that deterrence is of the most destructive forms of nuclear conflict would create instability at lower levels of confrontation, including conventional war and limited nuclear use. And this is what's referred to as the stability-instability paradox, where you have this idea where two nuclear powers or one nuclear power sort of feels, because I have this shadow, right, to sort of back me up, I can kind of do the things I want to do at the conventional level, maybe be more aggressive in some cases. And he references in his piece the idea of how the fact that Pakistan and India, both nuclear-armed states, went to war in the Kargil War in 1999, that either of their nuclear weapons didn't stop them from going to war. Well, actually, their mutual nuclear power sort of it didn't stop them from going to war, but it might have actually encouraged in some cases, or at least made them feel safe that they could get away with a small war, and that they could somehow be able to joust with one another under their mutual shadows, with this idea that we'll try to settle our differences here, but we're not going to resort to nukes. And so understanding some of these things is interesting. I do take one contention, though, or bone of contention, if you will, Jim, in that I don't know that nations choose to proliferate or not proliferate because they might feel they have an ally that's got them covered in an extended deterrence situation. I think they choose to do it because of their national interests, and whether or not their national interests demand whether they should have a nuclear weapon or not. We have to understand that nations do what they must to meet their interests. Usually the big ones are, right, sovereignty, security, prosperity. And if they can meet those three things, and if in order to meet those three things, they need nuclear weapons, well, like Pakistan said, they'll eat grass to obtain them, if that's what it takes. And so I think it is an interesting point here to note that having nukes does not preclude you from going to war. And having nukes doesn't actually protect you from those small pinpricks below the threshold of large-scale war. I mean, just take 9/11. People say, well, our nuclear arsenal didn't deter a terrorist attack on the United States. That's because it wasn't meant to deter a terrorist attack on the United States. And so you have to understand that there are weapons that have purpose, and those purposes are specific, and sometimes adversaries find a way around those things when their national interests demand it.
Yeah, let me solidify my argument just a little bit more, because I'm curious as you feel around the edges on that. And that is, you know, let's go in a way back machine and say we got to the point where we got to nuclear zero except for one country. Okay, if that one country had nuclear weapons and threatened you and you didn't have them, or threatened you if you started to build them, let's say it was a benevolent country that was not going to attack you unless you built those weapons, you wouldn't build them because of the threat. Now we don't have benevolency. You know, all humans are failed in my view. In the country, you take it to a country standpoint, imagine if Russia would have been the first to have nuclear weapons during World War II. You know, they would have taken out the Germans, I'm sure, and they would have been the first. Do you think they would have allowed the U.S. to build a nuclear weapons program after the war? I'm not sure that would have happened. I think that would have led to another use of nuclear weapons against them. What I'm saying is that the calculus that a country takes, I agree, countries will do what they need to do, but the calculus they take is different when you're a non-nuclear country and you want to start a program. Now, Iran, I'll be interested, you know, I'm interested because you guys have looked into this. I've always questioned, well, why is Iran pursuing a nuclear program that is leading to a nuclear weapon? Or how did North Korea do this? And the question is, was there a credible existential threat against them for doing so? And I don't think that happened. I think that's the failure. It's not that we have or didn't have it. It's that we didn't have the threat or the will to do that.
I'm going to let Adam answer this question, and then I'm going to see if he got it right.
Well, so if you let's suppose you're the Iranians. And you look to your west, and let's say it's about 2005. It's about the time the Iranian program was really starting to get hot and heavy. Well, who's to the west of you? Well, there's 150,000 Americans. And oh my gosh, who what did the Americans call you? They said you're the axis of evil in the world. And then, oh, damn, who's to our north? That's the Americans. Oh, and the rest of NATO's with them, by the way. So you've got the Americans on three sides of you, and they're controlling, the Red Sea, and they're in, the Indian Ocean. And so they're really surrounding you, and they don't like you. So you're the Iranians. What do you do? And what I would do is I would probably build nuclear weapons, because I know that the one member of the Axis of Evil who nobody's screwing with is the one country that has nuclear weapons, at least as of 2006, North Korea. So I want to be like the North Koreans if I'm Iran.
Well, before Curtis answers, though, I'm talking about prior to building weapons. So do you think North Korea felt there was enough of a threat? I mean, did we put enough of a threat to North Korea, and did we follow through on building weapons? I don't think we did.
North Korea is a totally different. For North Korea, it was about the Chinese and the Russians, because they felt abandoned by their longtime allies, and for them, regime survival was going to be done on their own.
So you don't think a threat of our nuclear weapons, if it was credible against them, would have stopped them in the process? I'm not advocating for it.
Probably not. Okay. I don't think it's credible. That's the thing is we don't really have first strike credibility with anyone.
I want to flip this argument around. I'm going to let Curtis speak. So what if Ukraine suddenly said, we're going to start building nuclear weapons? Do you think Russia would go nuclear on them? to stop
them? I don't know. It's an interesting
See, it's
question.
A difference from a, what I would say a benevolent versus a, I will call them a non-benevolent or maybe a
they're probably
aggressive.
More credible than we are in making that threat. That's probably true.
Okay. Now I'll let
Curtis start.
All right. Well, let me say, so let me grade Adam's homework, which I think is pretty good, right? So if you're a country of moderate military size and the great Satan has invaded all the countries around you with the purposes of regime change, and they're really good at it, you have no other choice but to nuke up, right? And so that is really what's going on there. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to say that we're creating this problem, okay? But what I am going to say is that we need to understand why nations behave the way they do in their own interests. Every nation has an interest in survival and doesn't want to be regime changed, including North Korea, which is why they have gone nuclear to, again, to Adam's point. The one thing I will say, though, with regard to North Korea is they are effectively deterred. I mean, they've not crossed the DMZ. They're not, you know, for the most part, they'll artillery an island every now and then or sink a ship. You know, that's kind of the cost of doing business in a very dangerous neighborhood. But there
let
are.
Let me poke you on that before
okay,
you finish.
Okay, poke me on
because,
that.
Because, you know, if you sink a nation's warship, that's an act of war. That is
only
an
if-
abject act of war.
Only if the other nation reacts, right? You're, you know, I mean, you got to understand that if you don't, if you just accept it and you don't do anything in response of credibility, then you've essentially said it's not the limit.
You know what's interesting about the sinking of the Chonon, which is what we're talking about, right? Curtis is referencing the rocks Chonon,
right?
And
right.
Or the you know, taking of the Pueblo or any of those sorts of things.
Yeah,
yes.
Or, you know, the shelling in like Waipido and these islands there, you know, for those of you not familiar, South Korea has islands that are technically north of the demarcation
the
line. And so, you know, the North Koreans will shell villages that just average citizens live in and kill them. And, you know, that is an abject act of war. And what's interesting is that I remember being in South Korea when this happened and the South Koreans, this was really when things changed because we used to be in South Korea to make sure that the North didn't come south. Now we're in South Korea to restrain the South from going north. That because South Koreans and young South Korean officers, they're much more aggressive and they think they can win this fight and they would like to win this fight. So it the relationship has in many respects, it's flipped where we're the constraining factor, right? We denied, you know, the South Korean jets fuel to go north. And, you know, this is one of the key things it's interesting about these kind of relationships, you know, but so to answer your question, the rocks, the South Koreans did see this as an act of war and they wanted to respond. And it was us that restrained them.
Okay. And that's a great segue to the last part of my answer, because Jim said, asked the question of whether or not, you know, the Russians would fear the Ukrainians if they decided to nuke up. And my answer is no, because the Americans would argue and prevent the Ukrainians from nuking up. When you go back and you look at South Korea, so we have a case study that's very recent, right?
Yeah.
There's active interest, you know, prior to all of the political issues they've had here recently, where, you know, 70% of the population said they needed their own nukes and they wanted to pursue organic nukes. This is all during the Biden administration. And as I said, we worked hard. The Biden administration worked incredibly hard to ensure that South Korea did not proliferate and become another nuclear state under the Biden administration's watch. That would have been terribly embarrassing to them. And so they worked very hard to the point where the president of South Korea publicly stated that they were not going to pursue nukes because they could not allow their economy to be punished by the sanctions that would be imposed on them, not by the North, but by their good friends, the Americans.
Yeah.
So they were more afraid of us and what we might do if they decided to nuke up than the North Koreans and what they might do or not do. And so, again, I think this is a, we work terribly hard to ensure that responsible first world nations don't do the things that they feel like they need to do in their national interests. And then we assume that burden from them, and then we bitch and complain about whether or not we can afford to buy the material to of which has assured them not to do it. And this is the paradox of American extended deterrence. You either have to be all in or all out. And I think we are still confused here as we try to determine whether or not we should allow responsible allies to do the things. We are demanding, President Trump is demanding that NATO nations step up and fund their to the point of 5% GDP. And now Poland is actively talking about it's time. It's time that we may need our own nuclear weapons, and Germany's asking to share French and British weapons, and they're all so afraid that the Americans are going to leave NATO. They're actually talking themselves into it now, at some point. And the reality here is that we're not interested in them doing that. But we're also not interested in providing the security that they want. We can't have that both ways. And we're going to have to realize that at some point.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jim, we are out of time. Did you have a last final comment for us?
No, I think Curtis is wrong, but that's okay.
I had one thing I wanted to say on this article, if we can squeeze in a minute or two here. Give me a minute here, because he really brings up this idea here that Iran, you know, of course, Iran, you know, sent a two salvos of missiles and drones against Israel last year, April and October, what was quite a spectacle of an attack, and also they exchanged strikes with Pakistan in January of last year, and that he was saying, see, this is a proof that that nukes don't deter. And on the side of the Pakistan thing, you know, if you look at the map, these are small villages just barely across each other's border. And Pakistan, to their credit, retaliated. When we look at Israel, who did also retaliate. But there's this argument about whether or not Israel is a nuclear state, right? And it never declared itself to be a nuclear state. And we can all speculate, and it may or may not be the worst kept secret in the world. But when you are going to live on strategic ambiguity, there might be a situation where the state attacking you doesn't believe you actually have them. And so if they don't believe that you actually have them, then the idea of nuclear deterrence kind of doesn't work. So I just think it's interesting where we consistently, deterrence requires capability and credibility. And you have to believe that the adversary has both of those for you to be effectively deterred, which means it is incumbent upon the deterring state to project those very clearly. So I want to leave us with that.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jim, Curtis, thanks for another great discussion. You know, it was an interesting topic we hadn't talked about before, so glad we were able to do that. Of course, thanks to you, the listeners. Make sure you check us out on Curtis's daily X feed at Think Deterrence. And then we've got, Global Security Review. If you're not reading the articles, there's a great lineup in the weeks ahead. You know, we've got lots of podcasts, Real Space Strategy Live. We've got QC events coming up. I think there's one Friday. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on. So, you know, go to the website, go to globalsecurityreview.com, go to Twitter or X, and see what all's happening. So thanks for listening. And of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501(c)(3) organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.